Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abba Yomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for this Friday, July 26, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal. This special edition of our program. Later on, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. Later on, we're going to pay tribute to Bernice Johnson Reagan, a co-founder of the SNCC Freedom Singers and also Sweet Honey in the Rock in later years. We'll feature a rare archival audio file of a presentation done by the Freedom Singers in 1965 at the University of California at Los Angeles. Right now, we'll take our musical interlude with the band Viva La Musica, headed by Papa Wemba from the Democratic Republic of Congo. These are some excerpts from a live television concert in 1983. Let's listen in. And I am Abba Yomi Azikiwe, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio.
Zongo zaki boko sanga eliye Bolongo inga motema boli bobongo Nakomi nanga mouma boli kamama
Et nous allons attaquer le côté le plus... Tout d'abord, forme oyo. Juste là nous termes, forme oyo, les alliés, les années 30. Les années 30. Alors, plus que moi, il a dit Giorgio, Armani, Giorgio.
Belle la yo, na kata tour efele bisengo o.
Kripango, Jojo Amaye, Kripango, Panama.
lati kolwezi yambo yenu
abari kani abari sana kasi lokola boyaki abuji boliaki ah boliaki
bantu ya Lubumbashi eske mulisha
bayemba mulisha kula
Dido senga na ye
na ye komi kwanza na yoge ya mama ye na ye o mama yo ye ya mama mo pa ya ko dido senga na mona kio na pense na ngongo senga loko la bebe madiongo dido o beta kinga loko la mkake na motema na tumi palo dia salie ye Yaka is a fortune.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Pan African Tunnel special worldwide radio broadcast.
Roll the shows. Roll the shows. Meso Mwaki.
Ah, 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 ah Papa, 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 papa
ngayo mwana mawa ngayo yo 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 arisana papa samela ngaye seke seke papa e samela ngaye esi pikolo e samela ngaye mukoko samela ngaye ichar ichar samela ngaye ngayo mwana mawa ngayo yo 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 ngaye mwana mawa ngayo yo 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 maestro papa Luciana oye mbela ngaye
na ina pesi nyoko na lawe yeko na mbela ngaye ake la pito
eke si nata kishana ngana nimiye nini kengalie mao ngana nimiye Yoko solo tumba asali singaye Chere aliseo abiki singaye Ngayo mwana mawa ngayo yo yo yo
Ngole la se
Mwana mawa ngayo yo 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 Nale la se bobo toba ninga bangaye Nale la nalo sambo na banana ngaye Kukuna mama e sambela papa e Anaendo sambela sambela papa e
Welcome back, and that was the music of Papa Wemba from a television broadcast in 1983 in the country now known as the Democratic Republic of Congo. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast, and of course, we are here broadcasting on July 26th, this Friday, of 2024. And we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Right now, we'd like to move into our Pan-African news segment of our program. These are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. The New York Times reported just yesterday, citing data from an analysis published by the Jewish Institute for National Security of America, that the U.S. has sent Israel a substantial quantity of weaponry since October 7th. The shipments include over 20,000 unguided bombs, approximately 2,600 guided bombs, and 3,000 precision missiles. The U.S. has also provided aircraft, ammunition, and air defense systems. Many of these transfers were kept secret or remain partially confidential, the report indicates. An analysis by the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in the spring found that the arms supplied up to March constituted, quote, an enormous number of and variety of weapons, unquote, which have been vital in supporting Israel's security apparatus. The analysis also suggested that it seems unlikely that Israel could attain across-the-board weapons and munitions self-sufficiency anytime soon. with some experts believing it may never be able to do so. Latest estimates from the Gaza Health Ministry reveal that the death toll has risen to 39,145 martyrs since October 7th, while the number of injured rose to 90,257. On Wednesday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited Congress to deliver a speech that featured several jabs at the International Criminal Court, which had requested the issuance of arrest warrants against him and his security minister, Yoav Gallant, for war crimes in the Strip. Among Netanyahu's claims concern food aid deliveries to Gaza, the protection of Palestinian civilians, and the mediated negotiations with the Palestinian resistance, all of which al-Mahdiyyin has compared with information and testimonies currently available to the public. On the same day, massive demonstrations were held outside the Capitol building before Netanyahu's speech, with hundreds gathering, waving banners, and chanting slogans against Netanyahu and U.S. President Joe Biden. Police reportedly used pepper spray on pro-Palestinian protesters while Netanyahu spoke to Congress. The protesters were demanding the arrest of Netanyahu for committing war crimes in the Gaza Strip. Among their other demands is an end to the genocidal war in Gaza and a halt to all arms supplies to Israel, according to al-Mahdiyyin correspondents inside the United States. And in the West Asian state of Yemen, the leader of the Ansar movement says that Yemen will not be deterred from supporting Gaza no matter the challenges and threats. The leader of the Yemeni Ansar movement, Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi, announced that the Yemeni support front has launched the fifth phase of escalation through Yafa to occupied Yafa operation, in which the Yemeni armed forces targeted Tel Aviv with a Yafa drone last week. In a speech delivered on Thursday, Saeed al-Houthi confirmed that the Israeli occupation was astonished by the operation and shocked due to the importance of the target that was hit and the long distance the Yemeni-made drone traveled. He stated that the distance crossed by Yafa exceeded 2,200 kilometers and that it managed to penetrate all the barriers and defense that the occupation relies on, provided by countries protecting it. The Ansar Allah chief emphasized that targeting Tel Aviv, which includes the occupation's most vital facilities, represents a critical point, pains the occupation and strikes its arrogance and presumption, asserting that hitting its means, there's no safe place left for Israelis in occupied Palestine. The drone operation terrified the Israeli occupiers residing in the area of the strike, Saeed al-Houthi said. And you're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In the Republic of South Africa, the South African Communist Party Provincial Executive Committee in Limpopo Province held an ordinary Provincial Executive Committee meeting on July 21st of this year to deliberate on the international and national political situation, on the state of the party program, South African struggle for socialism, and developments related to the results of the May 2024 national provincial elections. Following a central committee directive at the beginning of the year, the PEC and all other provinces had to focus solely and exclusively on mobilizing communities and workers, students and young people in general, the religious fraternity and traditional leaders, and all other sectors of the economy for an ANC-led alliance victory in the province and nationally. We will continue to draw inspirations and lessons from the relative success of our focused campaigning, which we planned and conducted severally and jointly with our alliance partners and the progressive movement as a whole. The PEC meeting took place in the midst of interesting developments internationally, all of which tend to have direct or indirect implications for South Africa and the continent. Most remarkable are inroads made in support of the people of Palestine. The Central Committee has already released statements in respect to South Africa's successful International Court of Justice case and the court's latest declaration of Israeli occupation of Palestine as a violation of international law. Similarly, the South African Communist Party will continue to mobilize and push for a much more concerted support for the peoples of Cuba, Western Sahara, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Swaziland, amongst others. The meeting also took time reflecting on the implications for the emergence of and rising ethno-nationalist populism and right-wing political parties in Europe, as well as the recent elections in France and the UK, amongst others. Developments in the USA and the incoming elections are of great interest to the South African Communist Party. And of course, in other news from the Republic of South Africa, on Sunday, July 21st, 2024, the South African Communist Party welcomed the groundbreaking decision of the International Court of Justice, declaring the continued occupation of Palestine as a violation of international law. The ICJ resoundingly denounced the Israeli settler states, Palestine colonization and occupation maneuvers, and declared that its continued presence in the occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful. Quote, "We call on the United Nations to talk immediately practical, decisive measures to reverse the apartheid Israeli settler state occupation of Palestine, hold its leaders to account, and stop its ongoing genocide on Palestinian people," unquote. That was a South African Communist Party General Secretary Sali Mapela said this from Johannesburg on Saturday, July 20th, 2024. The ICJ's groundbreaking declaration came at the time when the United States-backed apartheid settler state has unabatedly intensified its occupation of Palestine. Genocide on the Palestinian people, violation of the human rights of Palestinian people, and expansion of its aggression against other states in the Middle East, unleashing destruction and terror, violating the progressive thrust of international law. With that, we'll conclude our Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for Friday, July 26, 2024, all you need to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network. You can reach the Pan-African Radio Network at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
Oh, watching on Freedom's Highway.
Welcome back, and that was the legendary Staples Singers with the track entitled Freedom Highway. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast on this Friday, July 26, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. And just recently, we had the transition of a legend within the civil rights and people's movements here in the United States and indeed around the world, Bernice Johnson Reagan, who was born on October 4th, 1942, made her transition on July 16th of this year. She was a African-American song leader, a professor of history, a composer, historian, musician, scholar, curator at the Smithsonian, as well as a social activist who in the early 1960s was a founding member of the Freedom Singers, organized by the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the Albany Movement for Civil Rights in Georgia. In 1973, she founded the all-black female a cappella ensemble, Sweet Honey in the Rock, that was based in Washington, D.C. Reagan, along with other members of the SNCC Freedom Singers, realized the power of collective singing to unify the disparate groups who began to work together in 1964, Freedom Summer Protest in the South. After a song, Reagan recalled, "The difference between us were not so great. Somehow making a song required an expression of that which was common to us all. The music was like an instrument, like holding a tool in your hand." The Albany singing movement became a vital catalyst for change through music in the early 1960s protest of the civil rights era. Reagan devoted her life to social justice through music via recordings, activism, community singing, and scholarship. She earned her Ph.D. from Howard University, becoming a cultural historian. Centered on the role of music, she was professor emerita in the Department of History at the American University. She had also been a scholar in residence at Stanford and received an honorary doctorate of music from Berklee College of Music. And let's listen to a rare archival audio file, which features a speech and cultural presentation by the Freedom Singers delivered at the University of California in Los Angeles on April 8th of 1965, at the height of the mass civil rights movement in the United States, which had both national as well as global implications. The SNCC Freedom Singers were very much in demand, and of course, this appearance and lecture at UCLA was done right in the aftermath of the Selma,
I'd like to welcome you here this afternoon on behalf of the Student Legislative Council and the Graduate Student Association Council, who have taken perhaps the most relevant opportunity in the last 6 months to express a feeling which I think we've all had but perhaps haven't felt as strongly until the events of Selma, Alabama, to support in some way the civil rights movement. Today, we have a program in two parts. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Freedom Singers, who are themselves field workers and field secretaries for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the Black Belt of the South. Most of us here in the newspapers, Martin Luther King, James Farmer, Bob Moses, James Forman, the leaders of the civil rights movement. But the civil rights movement in the South have no leaders but the people of Mississippi and the field workers working in Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana. Most of us, I think, have felt, as a result of Selma, that we've been ignoring what to many of us is our duty to participate in the social revolution taking place in America today. In a revolution which is not fulfilled today and will not be fulfilled without further struggle. Always in the forefront of the struggle in the South has been the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Selma, Alabama, we heard of a month ago. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was in Selma, Alabama in 1962 and has been there for 3 years doing the long, hard community organizing which makes the demonstrations for voters' rights possible. Every organization in the civil rights movement has its role to play. For us as students, perhaps the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee has a role to play which is closer to us. Our fellow students are risking their lives, are giving up their futures to work in the South. We don't have to work in the South to participate in the civil rights movement. We have to work where we are. And in this action by our student governments, we have begun to work where we are, to do what we can to help bring freedom now. I'd like to ask you to please read the program, which you all should have, and to look very carefully at the list of things which must be done to support and advance the fight for freedom in America. And now, I'd like to get on with the most exciting part of the program. The songs of the civil rights movement are the movement. And here are the movement singers, the SNCC Freedom Singers.
Freedom is a constant dialogue. This time we'd like to introduce ourselves. My name is Chuck Neblett. I'm from Carbondale, Illinois. And I work for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee on Voter Registration Education in Southern Illinois, Missouri, Tennessee, Alabama, and Georgia.
My name is Emory Harris. I'm from Albany, Georgia. I worked in Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi.
My name is Raphael Benton. I'm from New York City.
And I'm Marshall Jones. I'm from Knoxville, Tennessee. I work with SNCC in Knoxville, Atlanta, and Yellow Springs, Ohio.
This time I'd like to tell you a little about the songs, the freedom songs. Most of the songs that you hear us do here this afternoon were either taken out of the jails, off the picket lines, or out of the mass meetings in the South. A lot of these songs are put to Negro spirituals, rock and roll, jazz, blues, now any phase of music that you could name except Bach and Beethoven. There's one thing I'd like to point out right now is that we're not entertainers. We didn't come here to entertain you. We come here to tell you a story through song, a very bitter story, one that a lot of people don't want to accept, but they're going to have to sooner or later because it's true. Now, the next song we're going to do was first done about 100 years ago in another phase of the freedom movement, but we still find ourselves singing the same song in somewhat the same way today. And the reason we do it like this is because, as far as we're concerned, the system hasn't changed all that much. They might have changed techniques, but the system is the same. And I'm sure all of you out there know this song. If you do, we want you to join in, sing, and clap along with us. It's Old Freedom. Old Freedom over me. And before I be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free.
Oh, freedom.
Freedom.
Oh, freedom.
Freedom.
Oh, freedom. Over me. Over me. And before I be a slave, don't you know I'll be a buried in my grave. And go home to my Lord. And be free, and be free. No segregation.
Segregation.
No segregation.
Segregation.
No segregation. Over me, over me. And before I be a slave, don't you know I'd be a baby in my grave. And go home to my Lord. And be free, and be free. No more bombing. No more bombing. No more bombing. Over me, over me. And before I be a slave, don't you know I'd be a baby in my grave. And go home to my Lord. And be free, and be free. No more Jim Crow.
Jim Crow.
No more Jim Crow.
Jim Crow.
No more Jim Crow. Over me, over me. And before I be a slave, don't you know I'd be a buried in my grave. And go up home to my Lord. And be free. Oh, freedom.
Freedom.
Oh, freedom.
Freedom.
Oh, freedom. Over me, over me. And before I be a slave, don't you know I'd be a baby in my grave. And go up over to my Lord and be free, and be free.
You know, at times we like to stick our nonviolent fingers into the stomach of our beloved country. 1963 in December, the State Department sent a Kenyan diplomat to Atlanta, Georgia on an integrated tour of the South. Now, when they sent Mr. Oginga Odinga to Atlanta, Georgia, they didn't want him to have anything to do with people like SNCC. So they bypassed our office. They wouldn't bring him to us, so we went to Mr. Oginga Odinga. He was standing in a hotel called the Peachtree Manor. And out of all the hotels in Atlanta, Georgia, they didn't have but two that was integrated, and he was in one of those, but they didn't tell him about that. So we went to Mr. Oginga Odinga, we carried him some freedom records, and we sat down and talked to him about the movement in the South. When we got through talking to Mr. Oginga Odinga, he got up and said the Swahili word for freedom. Yuhura! Yeah, and you know what that did? So we went out of the Peachtree Manor. We went out of the Peachtree Manor and went around to a segregated restaurant called a Toddle House, and we asked the waitress for a cup of coffee. She said with her unique Southern accent that we don't serve colored folk here. And what did she want to say that for with your hoorah ringing in our ears? So we just sat right there, and cut us all off to jail, and while we were in jail, we wrote a song, and it's called Oginga Odinga.
We went down to the Peachtree Manor to see Oginga Odinga. The police said, what's the matter to see Oginga Odinga? The police, he looked mighty hard at Oginga Odinga. Well, he got scared 'cause he was a handsome man
to see old Gingo, old Dingo. Oh, Gingo, oh, Dingo, oh, Gingo, oh, Dingo, oh, Gingo, oh, Dingo, of a Kenya. Oh, Gingo, oh, Dingo, oh, Gingo, oh, Dingo, oh, Gingo, oh, Dingo, of a Kenya. For you white folks who don't straighten up, I'm gonna call Joe Mokenyatta. Oh, Gingo, oh, Dingo, oh, Gingo, oh, Dingo, oh, Gingo, oh, Dingo, of a Kenya. Oh, Gingo, oh, Dingo, oh, Gingo, oh, Dingo, oh, Gingo, oh, Dingo, of a Kenya.
Segregationist to us is stubborn. Stubborn like the donkey is stubborn. The oppressed people are trying very hard to communicate with the segregationist. In the light of this fact, we chose a song which happened to be a novelty tune. It's a Latin American folk song, Hold Him Joe. In this song, it reminded us of this particular situation, where the oppressed people are trying to pull the segregationist from these ideas. Now, to us, the donkey reminds us of the segregationist. Now, in this story, Hold Him Joe, Joe is trying to pull the donkey. Joe reminds us of the oppressed people, trying to pull the segregationists to brotherhood, love, and understanding. Behind Joe, there is a girl whose name is Nelda. She is probably his girlfriend. Now, this whole thing happens in this village early one morning when people are coming out of their houses, going to work, and Joe and Nelda are trying to pull the donkey to get on his back to ride to town to buy groceries. And as the people pass them, they don't say, Joe, let me help you. Let me help you pull the donkey. All they say is, hold him, Joe. Hold him, Joe. Hold him, Joe, but don't let him go. Hold him, Joe, I say, hold him, Joe. Hold him, Joe, but don't let him go. Hey, the donkey won't water.
Hold him, Joe.
Spring round the corner.
Hold him, Joe.
Hey, the donkey won't water.
Hold him, Joe.
Spin me like a chumba.
Hold him, Joe.
Hold him, Joe.
Hold him, Joe. Hold him, Joe, but don't let him go. Hold him, Joe, I say, hold him, Joe. Hold him, Joe, but don't let him go.
We on a journey, we don't walk straight, and that's because we so underweight. The donkey of a mighty don't like no weight. Hold him on a cot, he never walks straight. Eddie donkey won't water.
Hold him, Joe.
Spring round the corner.
Hold him, Joe.
Eddie donkey won't water.
Hold him, Joe.
Fim me like a tumba.
Hold him, Joe. Let me go, darling Nelda. You're breaking my backbone. Let me go, darling Nelda. You're breaking my back. Ooh. Let me go, darling Nelda. You're breaking my backbone. Let me go, darling Nelda. You're breaking my back.
He is Nelda. Now,
I was just trying to help.
Some people say that me donkey is bad, but that is because he's from Trinidad. The donkey of a man, he won't break at all. All he want to do is break out the stall. Eddie donkey won't water.
Hold him, Joe.
Spring round the corner.
Hold him, Joe.
Eddie donkey won't water.
Hold him, Joe.
Spin me like a chumba.
Hold him, Joe.
Oh.
Sing the song like a soul brother. Singing like a black bourgeoisie or something. Put some soul into the song and sing it. It seems I've heard that word before. Soul. S. O L D.
No, no, oh, no, man.
Too many of those kind of brothers now.
S O U L.
Oh, just like you're saying when you're down in Mississippi.
On the block.
Don't let these white liberals out here scare you, man. You're up north now.
I didn't know they were out there. Now it all comes back to me. Soul. Why don't you give me some rhythm?
Now, you know we've been trying to get in the Metropolitan Office for 100 years. You know that. You know that. And if you got in, you couldn't play nothing but I Eat Our Old Cellar. So you might as well forget it. Now sing the song.
What a drag.
Sing the song.
That's what these integrated schools would do for you, dude.
Hold him, Joe. Hold him, Joe. Hold him, Joe, but don't let him go. Hold him, Joe, I say. Hold him, Joe. Hold him, Joe, but don't let him go. Hold him, Joe, but don't let him go. Hold him, Joe, but don't let him go.
I'm compromising with the system.
Now, back in 1961, when SNCC first went into Aitman County, Mississippi, to open up a voter registration project there, we met a man there named Mr. Herbert Lee. He was the first Negro in that county to become a registered voter. And his next door neighbor, who was a representative to the state's legislature, see, we don't have that hassle about housing in Mississippi. You know, we don't have the Proposition 14, anything like that. But they'd known each other all their lives. Because Mr. Lee went down and tried to register to vote and was encouraging other Negroes to do the same, Mr. Hurst didn't like it. So they met at a cotton gin one morning, and Mr. Hurst shot Mr. Lee down in cold blood. They called it self-defense. And we called on the FBI and the Justice Department at that time, and they said, we don't have enough men to send down to protect every Negro in the South, and this type of thing. So Mr. Lee left behind 9 children and a widow. One of his daughters had to drop out of college because they had no means of support. But to make sure that this man would never be forgotten, this young lady in SNCC named Bertha Gober wrote a song in memoriam of Mr. Lee. Now it's the theme song of the Mississippi Project. This call will never turn back.
We've been abused and we've been sold. We've been talked about, should you born. But we'll never turn back. No, we'll never turn. By ourselves, but we'll never turn back. No, we'll never turn back until we've all been free and we'll have.
Talking about housing. It's a funny thing, and we never can figure out quite why people have so many problems about living next door to each other. Now, it's a story down in Mississippi. A Negro family lived next door to a white family. Both families had a dog. Both families had a son, and each son had a dog. Two boys would look across this fence. They could never play with each other. They didn't know why at this point, but they wanted to. But they were always looking at their dogs. They would play together all the time. They would gnaw off the same bone, run down in the fields and the meadows. They never seemed to have too many problems. And if they did get in a fight, the next day they were playing again. And this happened to one of Snicksville's secretaries. And when this guy grew up, his name was Bevel. When he grew up, he thought about this thing. And he was wondering, if two things as simple as a dog can get along, run and play, and have no problem, then why can't we as human beings get along at least as well as two dogs? So he wrote a song, and the name of it is Dogs.
Dogs, dog, dog, dog.
My dog, I love your dog, and your dog, I love my dog, and my dog, I love your dog.
I'm talking about a favorite
dog.
I'm talking about a coon dog. I'm talking about a hound dog. I'm talking about a favorite
dog.
Oh, them dogs,
I love my dog.
Oh, them dogs,
I love your dog.
Oh, them dogs, Lord, Lord,
and your dog, I love your dog. And then why can't we sit under the apple tree? You won't walk with me, well, you won't walk with me, well, why don't you hold my hand and tell me, do you understand now? Can't you see that you and me, I would be so happy in the apple tree?
My dog was playing one day,
when a dog would double chick off, we took a dog,
downhill about Bonnie.
When a dog would double chick off, we took a dog,
my dog, it came along,
when a dog would double chick off, we took a dog,
say, let's get together and eat that bone.
When a dog double chick off, we took a dog, why can't we sit on the apple tree? You won't walk with me, well, you won't talk with me, well, why don't you hold my hand and tell me, do you understand now? Can't you see that you and me would be so happy sitting on the apple tree? My dog, I love your dog, and your dog, I love my dog, and your dog, I love my dog, and my dog, I love your dog, and your dog.
I'm talking about a rabbit dog, I'm talking about a coon dog, I'm talking about a hound dog,
I love your dog, and your dog,
oh, them dogs,
I love your dog, and your dog,
oh, them dogs,
Lord, Lord, and your dog, I love my dog, and why can't we sit on the apple tree?
You know, we always talk about what other people should be doing or what we would do if we weren't in a certain situation. If you're wondering who is responsible for the garbage in your front yard, who is supposed to move it? The neighbor next door? The neighbor across the street? Where does the guilt lie? Who is really guilty? The policeman who beat, shoot, and kill? The citizens who beat, shoot, and kill? The organizations who beat, shoot, and kill? The people who debate upon, decide solutions for, the people who look on and they don't do anything, are they guilty? Are you guilty? If all the rivers in Mississippi would suddenly run dry, and those many, many dead people could rise up and walk, those people would be coming out of those rivers for the next 6 months. Mississippi rivers, like the streets of Birmingham, like the bombed churches, should ring out through every state, every city, every country, through every school. In the Mississippi River, in the Mississippi River, in the Mississippi River, well, you can count them one by one. It could be your son. Count them a two by two. It could be me or you. Count them a three by three. Do you wanna see? Count them a four by four. Oh well, into the river they go. Oh well, into the river they go. Well, you can count them a five by five.
With the hand
they don't come out alive.
And the three.
And you can count them a six by six.
Oh, throughout the fire,
in Mississippi, they've got it fixed.
Like
you can count them a seven by seven.
And
the Mississippi River sure ain't a heaven.
And
you can count them a eight by eight. And we are thrown in because of a hate.
Well,
you can count them a nine by nine. In Mississippi, this ain't no crime. You can count them a ten by ten. And we wonder when the right will win. In the Mississippi River.
Cut off.
We're gonna stop them.
Tied by the hands.
We're gonna stop them.
Tied by the feet.
We're gonna stop them.
Thrown in the deep.
We're gonna stop them. In the Mississippi River.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to ask you to stay for 1 minute. There'll be another song. I'd like to introduce right now, I'd like to ask everyone to stay, please. I'd like to introduce Upper Division Women's Representative Bonnie Geller, who will present the Freedom Singers with a check for $500 to go to the South. Bonnie Geller and the Freedom Singers.
On behalf of the UCLA students, this check but represents the deep concern of the UCLA students for what happened in Selma.
Now could everyone stand, drawing hands right over left. We sang a theme song of the movement. We shall overcome.
We shall overcome.
My Lord,
we shall overcome.
My Lord,
we shall overcome someday. We shall brothers be,
my Lord,
we shall brothers be,
my Lord,
we shall brothers be.
That's it.
We shall overcome.
My Lord,
we shall overcome.
My Lord,
we shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my
thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. The panel of professors who were in the Montgomery March will follow immediately. I'd like to ask everyone not to stop with this. You can start right now, as a matter of fact, on your way out. Donations will be accepted and will be sent to the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Right now, I'd like to introduce Chairman of the ASUCLA Speakers Program, who will moderate the discussion today, Mr. Joel Boxer.
It'll take us about 30 seconds or 1 minute to move some stools and reset the mics. So if you all be patient, we'll start in about 1 minute. Thank you. I'm also 20 years old, which means I was born in 1944. A few years later, the last veteran of the Civil War died. Last week, four members of our panel were down at Selma still fighting the Civil War, or observing it at least. There's going to be 5 members of our panel today, besides myself. From left to right, Professor John W. Coy, Professor Roger Daniels, Professor Jerry C. King, Professor Robert Dalek, all 4 professors.
Some of his cats are here.
All 4 professors at the History Department at UCLA. Right over here is Ed Wilson of the local SNCC office, who will be able to answer some questions concerning local projects. The format we will use is a short presentation by each of the professors, and then we'll have a question and answer period afterwards. Thank you.
I'm sure you'll all agree that this is a hard act to follow. I do come as a member of a quartet, however, beginning with Mr. Dalek, Mr. King, Mr. Daniels over there. And I want to point out to you right at the outset that we are an integrated quartet. If you look carefully, you will observe that Mr. King is a European historian. The rest of us are American historians. First of all, a word of explanation of how it happened that some American historians decided to show up as such and join the March on Montgomery. The inspiration came in Chicago, as I understand it. Anyhow, I got a phone call from Chicago about 3 days before the last day of that march, saying that wouldn't it be a good idea if some American historians showed themselves in the flesh as ready and as supporters and participants in this March on Montgomery. I find that many people can't understand why American historians would do anything of this sort. That many people think that American historians are not the sort who are apt to do anything at all. But I assure you that this is perfectly natural, perfectly in character. After all, we as American historians have perhaps a greater involvement in American history than some members of the community would feel. It is our business. We have an interest in seeing that this story comes out right. We're going to have to tell it, we're going to have to report it, and to make our own lives tolerable, it's a good idea for us to do what we can to try to make this story have a happy ending. Not that I will live to see it. I'm not going to tell you when my birthday was. I don't think this is a precedent that must be followed just because Mr. Boxer bragged about his birthday. I don't expect to live to see the day when American history will actually have this happy ending. But at least I'd like to do a little bit, aside from talking and writing, in favor of some of the things that I think would be contributory toward bringing American history toward a better objective. Well, when I got this phone call, I called a couple of my colleagues to see if they would like to go with me down to Montgomery. First 2 I called said no. They had good reasons for saying no. I made 1 more phone call and got a very enthusiastic response, so I kept on going. And before long, by fanning out the phone calls, we had 6 or 8 or 9 members of the department who were eager to go. This raised something of a financial problem, since it was too late to charter a bus, too late to arrange sabbaticals from the university so that we could be gone for a long time. This had to be a hurry-up trip. We circulated a half sheet of paper in the department with a very mild come-on for others who might want to go or who might want to help somebody to go. And we found that there were a lot of conscience-stricken people on the campus, many in the history department, many conscience-stricken because they are practicing English history or Russian history or African history or some other kind of history than American history. I suppose we got some contributions which were really for the one-way ticket to Montgomery. But we didn't ask any questions. We didn't require any oaths of any sort of those who were ready to donate to this cause. After a while, we had enough money on hand to stage a lottery and pick out the lucky people, four of whom are before you. Norris Hundley is meeting a class right now, which questionable loyalty, but he's doing that at any rate, rather than making this performance a quintet. Off we went, therefore, not just as individuals, and not just as American historians, not just as members of this profession, but in a very real sense as representatives of a large number of persons on this campus. Some of them are colleagues in the history department, some of them librarians, some of them students, some of them research assistants, some of them administrators who had donated something to help us get out of town, get on down to Montgomery, and join this march. Now, there were various things about it that impressed on us that there was a certain amount of hazard in being party to a performance of this sort. When we landed in Atlanta and started off by bus, we found that we were being given protective covering in the bus that would take us from there toward where the march would pick up. We were riding in a school bus, which was labeled on the outside nursery and training school. And then the name of the ownership was there also, the Free For All Baptist Church. And under that disguise, which I suspect was anything but protective, so far as this bus ride was concerned, we made our way to Montgomery. Then in the march, we were protected doubly. The National Guard, standing at attention, its back to us, looking out at the empty streets to see to it that nothing evil befell us. We were guarded also by the Confederate States of America, flag flying boldly over the State House, and most of the members of the National Guard with a flag right here, appliqué on the uniform. We were guarded also by the governor of Alabama, who had issued an order, no doubt for our protection, that all women employees of the state of Alabama should have the day off and should stay at home. We had a safe escort in many ways to our destination, but still we didn't quite make it into the state capitol for the delivery of the petition to the governor of Alabama. Now, none of us pretend that we were heroes. There were heroes marching along with us, and there was at least one hero marching in spirit with us. And I should like to register his name with you if I contribute nothing else that you'll remember from my few remarks here. The name is Jimmy Lee Jackson, who was the first of the martyrs in the March on Montgomery, a young man of 26, a laborer, a farmer, a plywood cutter, a farmer of 2 acres of corn and peanuts, who ever since he was 21, that would be 5 years ago, has been trying to register to vote in Alabama. He was in some of the earlier action and the march toward Alabama. He saw his mother clubbed by a state trooper. He stepped up to the rescue and was shot by this state trooper. He's not so famous, nearly, as the Reverend Mr. Reeb or Mrs. Liuzzo. In some respects, he stands as, I know we shouldn't compare martyrs, but all three of these contributed immeasurably more to the cause in which we also were, in our slight way, concerned as we joined this march to Montgomery. Now, we're only allowed a few minutes. I probably exceeded mine, but I'm sure Roger Daniels, who's next, will make up for it. Roger?
I don't promise that, John. Some idealist thought that four professors could get up and talk only 5 minutes apiece. As some of you know, I'm not exactly that kind of an idealist anyway. We will probably all run a little bit over time, although Bob Dalek warned me that he had brought a cattle prod back with him from Alabama and that I might feel it if I stayed up here too long. While we were down in Alabama, the chairman of the history department, Professor Theodore Salutis, who was the treasurer of this fundraising of ours, got a phone call from an irate citizen and taxpayer and apparently parent, maybe one of your parents, maybe the parents of one of our students, and this taxpayer got through the switchboard and through the office and wanted to know from Professor Salutis why he allowed his professors, you know, to get out of the classroom. Why didn't he keep them in the classroom where they belong? And Professor Salutis, who is no mean man with a squelch, tells me that what he said was, our professors not only teach and write history, they make it. And then he hung up the phone. It's not that we're every way. One of our colleagues, a UCLA PhD from the state colleges who went, came back to find he'd been docked 3 days' pay. I hate to ruin a perfect squelch, but in truth, we weren't really making history. We were participating in a historical movement, but certainly the people who made history, the people who made the march possible, the people who were historic figures in that march were the Negroes, and let me say that apart from the Los Angeles Times, which got its figure from the L.A. Sheriff's, from the Montgomery Sheriff's Department, I was a newspaper man myself once, and I always estimate my own crowd. I estimate conservatively that there were 50,000 people there. Most of them were Alabama Negroes. Very few of them had walked all the way. There was an inhibition because part of US 80, which runs from Selma to Montgomery, is only two lanes, so only 300 walked all the way. But that those 50,000 Alabama Negroes were, as I look at my watch, I realize that exactly 2 weeks ago today, we were standing there, we were listening to some of the preliminary speeches, and we're about to hear Reverend Martin Luther King make his speech. But what was truly historic about that occasion was that here were 50,000 people, some white, a few college professors, there were 45 of us from the entire country, some people from outside of Alabama, but the vast, overwhelming majority of those people were Alabama Negroes, and they were the ones who were making history. And what was historic about it is where they were. They were in Montgomery, Alabama, the citadel of the Confederacy. When John Coy mentioned a moment ago about the Confederate flags, Mr. Boxer sitting next to me didn't believe it, and I happened to have a picture in my pocket of the state capitol, and I showed it to him. But what flies over the state capitol in Montgomery? A Confederate flag and a flag of the state of Alabama. No United States flag flies over the capital of the Montgomery State House. There is one, however, on the grounds of the state capitol. They still are part of the United States and will admit to this. It's, as you face the state capitol, it's off to the right. It's on a flagpole which is between two oak trees. As a matter of fact, since the flagpole is, I'm sure by design, about 6 feet lower than either of the oak trees, it's very, very hard to see the United States flag there, but it is there. And of course, there are not only Confederate flags as part of the uniform of the Alabama National Guard, even when it gets federalized, but the rear license plate of police cars in the state of Alabama is not a license plate at all, but also a Confederate flag. It makes one feel very, very much at home if one happens to be a Confederate in Montgomery. So into this capital of the old Confederacy came 50,000 Negroes with a few white people along to help them, along to lend them moral support. This was a historic movement. It wasn't the end of anything. It wasn't the beginning of anything. It was part of an historic movement. Now, I'd like to talk just a couple of moments about personal reactions about the trip there. We came down prepared to suffer, symbolically at least, for one day. I know I came down with candy bars in my pocket. I thought that might be all I'd get to eat. I brought a sleeping bag. As an old infantryman, I brought several pair of socks and some foot powder, and I was prepared for 24 hours at least to rough it. However, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference had extra ideas. I think they wanted us down there very, very much. They wanted us, symbolically at least, to represent the white intellectual establishment. They wanted us clean. They wanted us well taken care of. I began to get this inkling already in the Montgomery in the Alabama airport when we went upstairs on the sixth floor to a press conference arranged by Delta Airlines. We were interviewed by some of the newspapers. We were informed that no, we wouldn't be sleeping with the marchers. Instead, they were going to put us up in the very nice hotel-like guest house at Tuskegee Institute, which had been built originally by Booker T. Washington for white philanthropists. Then we got on that famous school bus, or among us it's famous. There wasn't too much leg room on the bus of the Free for All Baptist Church. I'm sure there are enough for the 6 and 7 year olders who normally ride it. But for a 5 hour ride for adults, it was mildly uncomfortable. And on that 5 hour ride, this was the press conference we held was a normal press conference, so there was liquor served on Delta Airlines. So I had four. And as we got out into the Georgia countryside, maybe about the time we crossed the Alabama state line, it's about 175 miles from Atlanta to Montgomery, about 130 miles from Atlanta to Tuskegee. And by the way, when you're driving a civil rights movement bus in the South, our driver was very careful to observe all the traffic regulations. That's one time you want to... You really want to be careful about what you do. We were warned not to jaywalk, not to walk on the grass, not to throw any paper on the sidewalk, not to spit, not to do any number of things. About an hour out, I asked one of the two staff people of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference when we were going to have a comfort stop. And he just sort of looked at me, and about that time we were passing through a little town, and we got what Southern Negroes, or Negroes, as a matter of fact, in the United States have known for a long time as the hate stare from all the bystanders. And I suddenly realized that although I was an American citizen and had never felt any compunctions about being afraid of the police or being afraid in my home or anything else, suddenly I realized that for that bus to stop anywhere in the 130 or 40 miles between outside of Atlanta, anywhere in the countryside, at any rural gas station, that this might set off a serious racial incident. So this didn't have to be explained to me. All of a sudden, I knew it, and I sat down in the back of the bus. I was back there with Professor John Hope Franklin, the University of Chicago, and he made many comments on this. He was the only Negro historian on there. This just happened to be fortuitous. But after the sun went down, I began to learn something else about the American South. Learn it as an individual, not as a historian, because I'm sure I knew all of these things intellectually. That was, as every car approached us from the rear, I noticed that Professor Franklin was craning his neck and looking very, very hard. And it suddenly occurred to me that perhaps there was some real danger, that perhaps somebody might come by with a sawed-off shotgun or a rifle or some such thing. And I asked him why he was looking around, and he said that he had known Colonel Penn, the assistant superintendent of Washington schools, who had been assassinated, murdered in this same way from Georgia, and he said they came from behind and that he wanted to see, you know, if anybody was shooting at him, he wanted to see what they looked like. One could go on with this sort of talk. I just want to close by saying that I was impressed more than anything else by the courage, by the quiet determination, the Negroes I saw in Alabama, and that this is their movement. It is they who are the heroes, and it is we who are privileged to participate with them. My colleague, Professor King, will tell you some more.
As a native of Birmingham, Alabama, who spent the first 20-odd years of his life either in Alabama or in the state of Virginia, naturally I had a somewhat different preparatory set to a return from the attitude of my colleagues. I had not been back to Alabama since 1953. I anticipated evidences of both change and continuity, and I found much of what I had expected to discover. In the first place, there are marked evidences of change, of, to me, a surprising degree of prosperity for the white community. The airport at Atlanta was almost as much of a model of modern architecture and of ingenious design and engineering as the Los Angeles Airport or the Kennedy Airport or Orly Airport of Paris, which I saw several years ago. As we flew low over the pine forest west of Atlanta preparatory to land, I could see stretching out below me a seemingly endless expanse of suburbia. It was almost as if I had not left Los Angeles with respect to urban or suburban sprawl. I went into the concourse and was hardly surprised to discover the first evidence of the stiffening white Southern reaction to the second Civil War, the first Civil War having been fought over the issue of preservation of the Union and, incidentally, slavery. The current Civil War fought out largely peacefully through nonviolent demonstration and through the courts. The current Civil War being a war for racial equality, which was not the purpose of the first Civil War, but believe me, it is the objective of the current Civil War. The South is digging in its heels and massively resisting. At the news kiosk in the concourse in Atlanta, I saw a stack of Confederate flags laid out horizontally awaiting the eager purchasers, no less than 3 or 4 feet high. The fact that we were ludicrously carrying sleeping bags in our hands proved to be a dead giveaway of our destination. Everyone who saw us knew we were ultimately on our way to Montgomery, getting in too late for the heroics, but just in time for the histrionics. I was transfixed with stares of reptilian hostility, which is precisely what I expected to find from my white compatriots. Having experienced it in Westwood Boulevard in Los Angeles when I and other members of CORE were picketing against Proposition 14. I frankly expected to hear epithets, insults, words of reproof, which I heard on Westwood Boulevard a year ago in the course of my picketing, but I didn't hear a single one in the 2 or 3 days I spent in the South, which is not to say that others did not hear them. I personally didn't. I hardly experienced surprise when I was reminded of the paradoxical beauty of the southern countryside. The first flush of spring was visible in the land. We traveled through endless miles of yellow shortleaf and longleaf pine forests, interspersed with clearings covered with broom sedge. Dogwood was in bloom. The red clay soil here and there lay bare with erosions and gullies. A strange country, a country of physical beauty and of psychological hideousness. There are few snake pits on earth as beautiful as Dixie. It reminded me of that grim verse about a land where every prospect pleases and only man is vile. When we belatedly got into Montgomery, I was surprised at the relative degree of apparent prosperity in the city. I've been there many times. I used to spend my summers 40 miles south in my grandmother's home in Greenville. There was a new 8-story Holiday Inn on the eastern outskirts of town. In point of fact, there was no less than a 4-lane freeway for much of the distance between West Point, Georgia and Montgomery. In my childhood, I used to wonder if I would ever live to see the day when there would be a paved road between my native Birmingham and Atlanta. Now there are no less than freeways. Then we drove on through the Negro District at the western end of Montgomery, on our way out to the great Catholic complex, the city of St. Jude. There was no evidence of change. The incredible hovels in which Southern Negroes lived in my childhood are the identical shanties in which they live now. We were encompassed in a sea of poverty. I was in India in 1956, and I have not seen such all-encompassing poverty since I left the subcontinent of India. As Martin Luther King said later in his magnificent speech the following day, the Southern Negro represents an island of poverty in a rising sea of American affluence. It had been a long, long time since I had seen so many Negroes massed together, as were massed together on the muddy playing field of the city of St. Jude on the Wednesday evening 2 weeks ago to witness the festivities presided over by Harry Belafonte and Sammy Davis Jr. and Dick Gregory, Peter Paul and Mary, Shelley Winters, Ralph Bunch, as well as Martin Luther King. And I was reminded again of what a magnificent-looking people the Negroes are. They're the last Americans who, by virtue of necessity, take exercise. They were sculptors' models. They were unlike the Negroes I had experienced, whom I thought I had known, and it is sheer bunkum for 99.99% of Southern whites to say they know the Negro. They do not know the Negro. The Northern college students who have spent 2 weeks as summer volunteer voter registration assistants and who sleep in Negro houses know the Negro better than the oldest average white man who lives in a world apart, as much as if he were an Indian Brahmin living in the midst of pariahs. But I could detect obvious differences in the faces of these magnificent-looking members of the human race. There was a degree of pride. There was a degree of determination. There was a realization that 350 years of injustices were on the verge of being righted. The next day, as we took part in the march, going the last 3.5 miles, protected by helicopters, by the National Guard, by regulars from Fort Benning, drawn up in riot control formation, we noted the delirious enthusiasm of the reception of gray-haired Negro men and women who were hysterically, publicly invoking God's blessing upon these white people who had come from heaven knows where to assist them in their moment of crisis and impending triumph. I took due note, and I realized that it was a thoroughly deserved feeling of humiliation over the difference between the attitude of young Negroes and the old Negroes. The old Negroes were the ones I knew in my boyhood, steeped in the usages and wont, poured out in the mold of Uncle Tomism and protective mimicry and survival through sweet-talking the white man. The attitude of the young Negroes toward our presence, as best I could divine it, was, good, you're here at last, but where have you been for the past 350 years? High time that you are here to take your place beside us in righting wrongs which have been an integral part of this society since 1617. I was taken aback by the lackluster response of Negro schoolchildren to our determined waves. They looked at us either suspiciously
or apathetically, as well a white, as well as a Negro child in the South might regard a white stranger. But to me it was a transcendent experience to walk up the broad expanse of Dexter Avenue, to see the state capitol at the summit of the hill where my father served in the legislature from 1908 until 1910 and where my grandfather served in the 1890s, and to realize that a new day was in birth. This isn't to say that when the Negro gets the vote, within a few months or a year or two, that there will be sweetness and light and brotherhood and mutual love and harmony in this country. He will then be in the position of the European Jew, the French Jew, who in 1791 was, after several thousand years, made a French citizen, the Prussian Jew, who got citizenship in 1807, the English Jew, who didn't have to face religious tests for admission to Parliament after the 1870s. This meant an end of legal inequality, but did it mean the end of discrimination? Did it mean the end of injustice, of nastiness? Of course it didn't. This was a dreary and sobering reflection, which I expressed to John Hope Franklin on the bus in riding from Montgomery back to Atlanta. He agreed with me completely. We are on the verge of a great breakthrough. The Negro will shortly have equality in Montgomery before the law. He will be no more disfranchised than he is in Los Angeles. And where is he in Los Angeles? How many Negroes live in Westwood Village? What would happen if a Negro moved next door to me on McKendree Avenue in Pacific Palisades? This is the problem of all of us, and is a problem which will be solved. I want to present my colleague, Mr. Dalek, who, unlike me, was not making a belated and a traumatic return, but who was going to the South for the first time, and who therefore was able to view it with fresh eyes.
First, I wouldn't want to say anything about the King contest, and so I won't. As Mr. King, Jerry King, has pointed out, I had never been to the Deep South before, nor had I ever been a participant in a civil rights march. And so I think that some of my impressions might be of particular interest to those of you with little or no involvement in the civil rights movement. And the chief impression which I carried away from Alabama is that the march was, and the movement is, predominantly led by Negroes. And I raise this point because when I was at the dormitory on Monday night with Jerry King, some people asked the question, well, why four white historians who have gone to the march? Is this a white man's movement? Is this a Negro movement? And what I tried to emphasize there, and what I think we both tried to emphasize, was the fact that it's very much a Negro movement, a movement led by Negroes, a movement in which Negroes participate. Indeed, as I was whisked from Montgomery to Atlanta, Georgia, immediately after the march, and from Atlanta to Los Angeles, and I might say it may be the only time in my life I'll be absolutely ecstatic to get back to Los Angeles, I appreciated the accuracy of President Johnson's remark that, quote, the real hero of this struggle is the American Negro. For where I could retreat to the safety of my home and job here in the West, the Negro in Selma and Montgomery faced the retaliation of Governor Wallace's state troopers, state police. And the Episcopal Bishop of Los Angeles, with this in mind, sent four observers to Selma to guard against such action. And well he might, for a Unitarian minister in Los Angeles, in the city, who stayed on in Montgomery after the march, saw police beat and brutalize Negroes who had participated. But what did I see on the march? As I marched through through the Negro District of Montgomery from St. Jude's, the Catholic Institute from which we all began the march, I saw elderly Negro women, some crying, some overjoyed, and some greeting us with cries of God bless you. Thank you for coming. I saw a Negro driver climb out of his milk truck to offer us containers of milk. One of our group who accepted and offered to pay was put off with the words, "Today, you're marching for me. This milk is free." I saw, as we passed from the unpaved, muddy Negro district into the paved streets of the white section, a Negro woman responding bravely to our greetings with enthusiastic waves, while whites subjected us to what Mr. King calls or describes as stares of reptilian hostility. And the thing that somehow most impressed me about this woman in the white district was that apparently she was the maid, servant of this in a white home. And the whites from the home were standing out in front of the porch while the Negro woman was off to the side in the driveway, in the alleyway. And we greeted her, we waved to her, or we nodded her to her. And she responded with great joy and enthusiastic waves, as I say. And the whites somehow were terribly embarrassed, and they laughed at us. They were indignant. And somehow we were dignifying, you see, white people were dignifying this woman with recognition, and we were ignoring them. And somehow it made them terribly indignant, and somehow the only way it seemed that they could respond was with great embarrassment. As I moved through the downtown or central section of Montgomery, and as I looked back up Dexter Avenue, I saw thousands of marchers singing, chanting, walking very, very proudly, I think, and certainly that was my feeling, one of great pride, very proudly toward the steps of the state capitol. And at the foot of the steps, when the thousands had assembled, I saw and I heard the Negro leaders of the civil rights groups, one by one, advance to the microphone and share in that hour, in that day of victory. "We have come not only 5 days and 50 miles," their petition to Governor Wallace read, "but we have come from 3 centuries of suffering and hardship." "How long will it take?" I heard Martin Luther King ask. And I heard him reply, "It will not be long, because truth pressed to earth will rise again." "How long? Not long, because no lie can live forever." "How long? Not long, because you still reap what you sow." "How long? Not long, because the arm of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." And as I heard Dr. King's reply, I was reminded of the poem by the Negro writer Langston Hughes, "What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode? Or does it explode?" "How long?" Martin Luther King asks. "How long?"
Before I introduce Ed Wilson of SNCC, I'd like to tell you the rest of our program and explain what we're going to do. We have till 2 o'clock because the room is being used and some of the professors have to go back to classes. I suppose they don't want to be docked pay. But the purpose of this meeting today, which started at 12 o'clock, is not to present an oral Time magazine. We don't intend for it to be thrown away at the end of the week and we get the next issue. 4 professors here have office hours. Ed Wilson has office hours. He has ours. We all have ours. I hope that when we get done at 2 o'clock, we can think, is it over? And if the answer is no, we can decide to do something. Now I'd like to present Ed Wilson, the SNCC organization, might give us a few ideas of what we can do, and then after he speaks, we'll take questions from the floor.
Well, what I'd say will be very brief. There's one picture about the happenings in Selma that probably were clouded over by the march and by the fact that the march took place. Because to a certain extent, see, the march in Selma, Alabama was largely unreal. Now, when I say it was unreal, I mean, I don't mean it wasn't significant. You see, when I say it's unreal, what I mean to say is a statement that Mr. King made about here were whites coming down to Mississippi to help the Negro in time of crisis. And something that the first speaker said when he was talking about Jimmie Lee Jackson. And something that Mr. Dalek said when he was talking about the Negroes who are left when the waves of whites go home. See, this is a big question that I want to raise, the question that many, many times in presentations about this historic march are overlooked. First of all, let me relate a few things that happened in the South during the time that Selma was in the news and that everybody heard about Selma. Jimmie Lee Jackson was killed. Of course, you got some publicity about it because he got killed in Marion County, which was next to Selma. In Mississippi and Rankin County, you had two people killed about 2 days after Jimmie Lee Jackson was killed. In Louisiana, you had a boy beaten up for Mardi Gras and killed. 4 killings that month. In terms of projects in the Deep South, in Mississippi, we had a series of freedom schools and community centers bombed. The center in Laurel, Mississippi was completely destroyed, and the library, about 3,000 books, was burned. An effort that it took the people in Laurel, Mississippi, along with the help of whatever northern support they could muster, 4 months to build. Same thing happened in Batesville, in Panola County. Community center bomb and the Freedom School burned. Same thing happened in Columbus, Mississippi. You see, and the same thing happens all over the South. Now see, in one case, you get a lot of publicity. The white minister got killed. The wife of the Teamster executive got killed. A lot of publicity. 3 civil rights workers this summer got killed. A lot of publicity. When the Freedom Singers were talking about that historic Mississippi River and the Tallahatchie River and the rest of the rivers down south, and about the fact that if those dead Negroes in that river got up and started walking out, they'd be coming out for the next 6 months. I mean, they weren't kidding. We have counties. I believe Chuck, when he was up here, mentioned Amite County in Mississippi. Before the 3 civil rights workers got killed in Philadelphia, we had 6 people killed in 6 months in that county. And you see, this is what I'm trying to say. We cannot forget that those people in the South, those Negroes in Mississippi and those Negroes in Alabama, you can't come home. They have to stay there. And even though this march did quite a bit in showing that there was a nation supporting these people, you see, there is a definite need for further support. That further support has to come. People, Negroes in the South, have to become able to handle their own affairs, have to be able to make their own decisions, have to be able to make those decisions which affect their lives. Now, the program that SNCC is presenting is a program which is complementary to the other programs which are going on. You see, every group in the civil rights movement has whatever function it serves. Every group has a function. You see, and now you have had some exposure to events in Mississippi. And now you've had some exposure to events in Alabama. You see, and now the time has come for you to decide whether you are just going to be satisfied with having this exposure or whether you're going to do something to support the problem that's down there.
Welcome back. And that was a recording of a forum at University of California at Los Angeles in April of 1965, featuring the second rendition of the Freedom Singers and a panel discussion of historians from University of California at Los Angeles who traveled to Alabama to participate in the Selma to Montgomery March. And, of course, a partial address by Ed Wilson of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. That's going to conclude our program for today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast. We've been broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Today is Friday, July 26, 2024. And if you'd like to have access to this program, just go to the Pan-African Radio Network. You can reach the Pan-African Radio Network at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And you can read the Pan-African Newswire at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. We'll close out with the music of John Coltrane, Tommy Hannigan, Kenny Burrell, Idris Suleiman, and this is from 1957. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off. And have a beautiful day.
Thank you.